All right, we are in Numbers 34. So last week we did Numbers 32 and 33, where Reuben and Gad and half tribe of Manasseh ask for Transjordan. And we talked about how that was not necessarily a good thing. Moses freaks out because he's afraid they're in for a repeat of what the spies did. And he's like, we just finished our 40 years wandering. We don't want another 40 years wandering for another generation to die out, right? So, but they come up with a compromise where Reuben, Gad, half Manasseh will send their troops across the Jordan to fight for the promised land, and then they can have that as their inheritance. Then in Numbers 33, we got a review of their journey starting in Egypt to the plains of Moab where they are now, across from Jericho, and it's from there that they're going to enter the promised land. Okay? Then the last little bit of 33, God gives them instructions on what they are to do once they enter the promised land. They're to drive out the people, and most importantly, they are to destroy all their gods. Okay? And the other people's gods. Yep, because they're only to have one God, and we know that they don't do that perfectly. They don't do anything perfectly. Okay? So, now we're in Numbers 34. Numbers 34 and 35 point to... They deal with issues that are going to be relevant once they have finished their conquering, okay? So chapter 34, God is going to give Moses boundaries of the promised land. What constitutes Canaan, okay? And it's interesting that the borders God gives very clearly does not include the Transjordan, okay? Where Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh are. So can someone read for me verses 1 through 15 of chapter 34?
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall to you as an inheritance, even the land of Canaan according to its borders. Your southern sector shall extend from the wilderness of Zin along the side of Edom, and your southern border shall extend from the end of the Salt Sea eastward. Then your border shall turn direction from the south to the ascent of Akrabim and continue to Zin, and its termination shall be to the south of Kadesh Barnea, and it shall reach Hazardah and continue to Asmon. The border shall turn direction from Asmon to the brook of Egypt, and its termination shall be at the sea. As for the western border, you shall have the Great Sea, that is, its coastline. This shall be your west border. And this shall be your north border. You shall draw your border line from the Great Sea to Mount Hor. You shall draw a line from Mount Hor to the Lebo Hamath, and the termination of the border shall be at Zedad. And the border shall proceed to Ziphron, and its termination shall be at Hazar Enan. This shall be your north border. For your eastern border, you shall draw a line from Hazar Enan to Shechem, and the border shall go down from Shechem to Riblah on the east side of Ann, and the border shall go down to reach to the slope on the east side of the Sea of Kinneret. And the border shall go down to the Jordan, and its termination shall be at the Salt Sea. This shall be your land according to its borders all around. So Moses commanded the sons of Israel, saying, this is the land that you are to apportion by lot among you as a possession, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. For the tribe of the sons of Reuben have received theirs according to their father's households, and the tribe of the sons of Gad according to their father's households, and the half tribe of Manasseh have received their possession. The 2.5 tribes have received their possession across the Jordan opposite Jericho, eastward toward the sunrise.
Okay, so if you want to pull out this map, it will be very helpful in discussion. So the colorful one. Okay, because this map, what's green, is our best guess of what, because we don't know where all these places are. And what's in like the pinkish purplish, that's Transjordan. But what's green, that's what these borders are in Numbers 34. Okay. So verses 1 and 2, again, God speaks like he's done all through the book of Numbers. And he is telling Moses what the borders are, and he is supposed to pass that on to the rest of the nation. It's in Joshua 15 through 19 where they actually divide up this land, and it's within these borders. Now, it's interesting to note, the book of Joshua, they do not conquer this entire green part, okay? God said in Genesis, I believe, that he would drive the people out slowly so that the land wouldn't, you know, go to waste if Israel couldn't move in fast enough to settle it all. So he was going to drive it out slowly. Okay, so verses 3 through 5, we have the southern border. So that's going to be down here, obviously, in the south. Okay, he talks about the wilderness of Zin, which you can see is down here. And this is where they sent the spies out from. Okay, so when they came up, they were right on the border of the land God had promised them. And from the wilderness of Zin, they send the spies up to spy out the land. Okay, then basically it goes from the Dead Sea, which you see the Salt Sea has a small little portion at the bottom that's the south. And then it goes over to the Mediterranean. And the border is this brook or river of Egypt. Okay, this is modern-day Wadi El Arish, which you can see that name down here. And if you can see the faint little yellow line, that goes south a little bit, but then it continues up and it goes to the Mediterranean. Do we see that? Okay, so, but it says it goes just south of Kadesh Barnea, so we know their border isn't all the way down here as well. And Asmond, you can see there's a question mark. We think that's where it might be, but we're not sure. Okay, that's the best guess. Then the west border, that's easy, right? It's the Great Sea or the Mediterranean Sea, so all the way up. That's super simple. The Israelites called it the Great Sea, right? Because that would have been the only real, they had the Red Sea down below and lakes and stuff, but that would be the biggest ocean. And it's the Philistines occupied the southern coast for much of Israel's history. You can see Gaza there. That's around that area is where the Philistines would be. Okay, and they were seafarers, so that's why they inhabited the coast. Okay, the northern border. This is where it gets a little, my photocopy, I guess, cut it off. But you can see it says Mount Hor ? At the very top. This is obviously a different Mount Hor than the Mount Hor where Aaron died, because the Mount Hor where Aaron died is down here in the south. Okay, so we don't know exactly where this Mount Hor is. We think it's part of the Lebanon Mountains, okay? Because, it had to be somewhere relatively close to the coast, because it says in verse 7, this shall be your northern border, you shall draw your borderline from the Great Sea to Mount Hor, right? So it's going to be somewhere close to the coast, up there, up in the north. And then it goes to Lebo Hamath, which you can see is here. They have it located here kind of in the land. But again, it has a question mark. So we're not exactly sure where these places are. So you have to do some guesswork to see how it works. Okay, but the interesting thing about Lebo Hamat, if you go to Numbers 13:21, can someone read that for me? Okay, so when they sent the spies out, they go from down here all the way up here. This is modern-day Lebanon or Syria, okay? Modern-day Israel stops just north of the Sea of Galilee, I think. I don't remember. Yeah.
It's not much farther than that.
Yeah, just north of the Sea of Galilee. So the Promised Land, this is Lebanon is on the coast, and then this is modern-day Syria up here. So when the spies went up, they went pretty far up north, okay? And then also, can someone read for me 1 Kings 8:65? Yes, 1 Kings 8:65.
So Solomon observed the feast at that time, and all Israel with him, a great assembly from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of Egypt before the Lord our God for 7 days and 7 more days, even 14 days.
Okay, so the entrance at Hamat, that's the same place, Lebo Hamat, okay? So he said, this is when Solomon dedicates the temple. He said, invites the people from the brook of Egypt, which is south-south, all the way up to the north-north. So it was only during David and Solomon that Israel basically got all of the promised land. Okay? It wasn't until David that it got conquered. Solomon held the land, and when he dedicates the temple, he's inviting people from all of Israel, right? From the brook of Egypt to Lebo Hamat. Okay? And then you get Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and there it crumbles. Okay? So God promises this land to them. They only held it for a very short period of time under David and Solomon. Okay? But one day, it will be, they will get all of it and exactly everything that God promised them. Okay? When Christ comes to rule again. Okay, so that's the northern border. And then if you look at your map again, there are Hazar Enan. There's a question mark. We don't know exactly where that is. Okay, and that's the furthest east north city, northeast city that we have listed. Eastern border is verses 10 to 12. We do not know where Shechem, Riblah, and Ain are. If you notice, they are not even on your map at all. We don't have any idea where those places are. So the eastern border, until we get to the Sea of Galilee, that's all guesswork. Okay? So there, we haven't found it yet. They have Riblah, I just saw this, they have Riblah up here in the north, okay, with a question mark, but it seems, according to the text, that it should be somewhere on the east, okay? So we're not sure where these are, so until the Sea of Galilee, we're not sure exactly what that border looked like. The Sea of Kinneret, Sea of Galilee, it's the same thing. Kinneret is just an older name for the Sea of Galilee. Okay. Then, after you get to the Sea of Galilee, the eastern border is super easy because it's just the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea, and we know where all those things are for sure. Okay. So, some of the northern border is unsure, and definitely the eastern border is unsure. But as far as we can tell, you know, then this is the border, or very close to what the border would have been that God is giving them. Dead Sea is at Salt Sea. Yes, it's the same thing. Dead Sea and Salt Sea. Yep. I mean, it's called the Salt Sea because the salt content is so high. It's also called the Dead Sea because the salt content is so high, nothing can survive in it. And then that's why the buoyancy is so much because the salt content is so high. Yeah. It feels like you're swimming in oil. It's gross. Yeah. I mean, it's cool to go say you did it, but it's not. It's supposed to be really good for your skin and everything, but it doesn't feel nice. But all the minerals and stuff, yeah. Yeah, it's really good for your skin.
This true salt, like from the earth, has so many minerals. I mean, iodized table salt
has nothing.
But real salt, yeah, there's so many minerals that help your skin.
Yeah. Okay. So again, like I said, these boundaries are much larger than the area that Israel conquers in the book of Joshua. Okay. And then again, under David and Solomon, they controlled most of this area for a very short period of time, and then it was lost again. Verses 13 to 15, Moses clarifies that these boundaries are now only going to be for 9.5 tribes because 1.5 tribes picked their inheritance in Transjordan.
Why again is it half the tribe? Is it called the half tribe?
Because they get split up. They inherit over here, and then they're also going to inherit over here around where it says Canaan.
Okay, so that is why. They
yes. The half tribe. So the tribe of Manasseh got split. So several clans decided to settle Transjordan, and then the rest of the tribes settled in Canaan proper. Yep. Good. Any other questions? All right. Verses 16 to 29, we're not going to read because it's just a bunch of names. Okay. Here, I'll read 16 and 17. 18. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, these are the names of the men who shall apportion the land to you for inheritance, Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. You shall take one leader of every tribe to apportion the land for inheritance. These are the names of the men. So God specifically chooses the man from each tribe that is going to be responsible for dividing up the land. So the who goes where is going to be chosen by lot, but then these men are also going to have the job of within their tribe saying who goes where in their allotment, right? Because families need to know where they're going to go or what they're, you know, so it's a big deal. So God specifically chooses who is going to be over it. Joshua and Eleazar, it's going to be the high priest, and Joshua is taking Moses' spot as leader of the nation as a whole. They're kind of like the head honchos, but then all the nitty-gritty stuff is going to be done by these men. Okay, and God specifically calls them out. The only name that we are familiar with that is anywhere else in Scripture is Caleb from the tribe of Judah, Caleb the son of Jephunneh. Okay, so he was also the other spy that was good. He is one of only two, or I guess three, Joshua, that are from the older generation. Okay, but he's the only one that we have anywhere else. Okay, and this apportionment of the land is going to be for all future generations. So this was a big deal. So you wanted to make sure you got it right and you got your full portion of the land. Then as they conquered more, I assume that tribes spread out a little bit more. But
so because Joshua is the new leader, he's not going to be part of the tribe? Or how does that work?
No, he would still inherit land. I believe Joshua's from Ephraim. So he would still have his, but he is going to oversee everyone. There's somebody from Ephraim.
Okay.
If I can find it. In verse 24 of the tribes of the son of Ephraim, a leader, Kemuel, the son of Shiftan.
Oh.
Okay, so there's going to be, because Joshua is going to be over everybody, that God picks a specific person over Ephraim who's responsible, but then Joshua would have inherited a portion of that land as well. He just has bigger fish to fry, so he's not going to be worried about the nitty-gritty of his specific tribe.
Gotcha.
Yep. Good question. Any other questions? Yes, it goes according to the census in chapter 26. So actually what's interesting is Simeon. Here, if we go back to chapter 26. Simeon only has 22,200. Now remember, these are fighting men, so age 20 years old and older. This does not include women and children. Okay, and yeah. In verse 14, it says, these are the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. Okay, compared, they are by far the fewest. The next smallest is Ephraim with 32,500. Okay, so Simeon is by far the smallest tribe, and their portion, they actually inherit in the middle of Judah. They have this really small portion of land in the middle of Judah's inheritance. Because Judah is the biggest tribe. They have, 76,500. I mean, so Simeon is a very small portion of that.
Yeah. I was wondering why Simeon was in the middle.
Yes, it's because they're so small that they just get a little chunk of part of Judah's. And really, for all intents and purposes, Judah kind of swallows them up. And they're not very, and why is that the case? Why is Simeon so small? Do we remember? No. It's in Numbers. It's all in Numbers.
Yeah, was there some kind of a battle and they lost a bunch?
No.
No, the Simeonite man and the Canaanite woman.
That's exactly right. Baal Peor. Chapter 25, right before chapter 26, it is a Simeonite leader who brings in Cosby, the Midianite woman, right into the middle of the camp, basically parades her before the tent of meeting, before God and, you know, everybody, and was like, I don't care, this is what I'm doing. And that's when Phinehas comes in and he shish kebabs them both, right? But because of that in-your-face blatant sin, part of the punishment of that is that whole tribe is diminished, right? So when they inherit based on the numbers in Numbers 26 of how big your tribes were. So if you were a larger tribe, you got more land. So Judah's going to have the largest inheritance because they are by far the largest tribe. Simeon is going to have the smallest inheritance because they are the smallest tribe. Okay. And I don't think, let's see. Some of your Bibles in the back might have, this doesn't. My Bible does not. I have a very tiny map in Joshua. Some of your Bibles might have a map of the how they divided it all out. I didn't print one out for you. When we get to Joshua, if we get to Joshua, I will provide you with that map. Okay, good. Any other questions? No, you don't have any questions, Abby? Okay. Yeah. Of how they divided up the land.
He's got, like, Atlas things.
Yeah. All right. Leviticus 35.
Numbers.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm a whole book back. We're almost done with Numbers. I'm still in Leviticus in my brain. Leviticus doesn't even have 35 chapters. Numbers 35. Okay. It's the title of your in your Bibles might be Cities for Levites, but we are now going to deal with the Levites. If you remember, the Levites do not inherit land. It says that Yahweh, yep, they are the priests and the Levites. They serve in the tabernacle, and God is their inheritance. So they do not get land, okay? But they still need some place to live, and they still need to be taken care of. So this chapter deals with all the tribes have to provide cities for the Levites to live in, and also what are called cities of refuge. A city of refuge is somewhere where you flee if you kill somebody. Okay? Or not. Yeah, we'll talk about it, but yes. So the Levites were going to be settled all throughout Canaan and Transjordan. All the tribes had to provide some cities for the Levites. In total, 48 cities are going to be given to the Levites. And with the Levites spread throughout all the tribes, this would be a constant reminder, theoretically, right, if they don't all rebel, but a constant reminder to Israel of their covenant with God, right? Because those who are specially set out to serve God are mixed all among you, all throughout the land. Okay, can someone read for me verses 1 through 5?
The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, command the people of Israel to give to the Levites some of the inheritance of their possession as cities for them to dwell in. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to dwell in. And their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their livestock and for all their beasts. Their pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits. The city being in the middle, there shall belong to them as pasture land for their cities.
Okay, so again, this instruction is straight from God, and he's telling Moses what he has to tell the people. Again, we are on the plains of Moab, reminds us we are opposite Jericho. These are instructions that Israel needs before they enter the land. Okay, God says, verse 2, command the sons of Israel. This is not an option. Okay, they have to. The Levites don't get an inheritance, so all of the rest of the tribes have to provide cities within their inheritance for the Levites to live in. Okay. This would help provide for the Levites, and their presence, again, would be a constant reminder of Israel's covenant with God. Also, Israel should want to do this because God took the Levite tribe instead of all the firstborn sons, right? After Egypt, all the firstborn belonged to God. All the firstborn belonged to God. Animals, you still would give to God. But people, God said, instead of taking all your firstborn and having them serve me, I'm going to just take a whole tribe. Okay? So the Levites were basically in place of everybody's firstborn. In Numbers 18, verse 20, I can read it really quick. It says, Then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor own any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the sons of Israel. It's Numbers 18:20. Okay, so God was their inheritance. And so, but they still need a place to live, so they get these cities. And also, the Levites got the tithe. Okay, I mean, and that's, I think, 18 verse 21. To the sons of Levi, behold, I've given all the tithe in Israel for inheritance in return for their service. So remember, the tithe was 10%. Every 10th animal, 10% of all your produce. So with the Levites scattered throughout the land, it makes it a lot easier and more practical for people to pay their tithe than for everyone to have to drag every 10th animal to Jerusalem. Okay, so it just is a lot more practical for them to give their tithe to the Levites. Okay. In Joshua 21, it says what the cities are and how they were split up. And each member for the Levites, there are three clans, the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merariites. And they each get a certain number of cities in certain tribes. So meaning, if you're a Kohathite, you're not going to have one city in Judah and one city way north in Dan and one city over in Reuben. Okay, the Kohathites that were the priests, descendants of Aaron, got 13 cities in Judah, Simeon, which is going to be part of Judah, and Benjamin. Okay, so that's how they were divided up. The rest of the Kohathites had 10 cities in Ephraim, Dan, and the half of Manasseh that was in Canaan. Gershonites had 13 cities in Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and half of Manasseh, Transjordan. And then the Merariites had the 12 cities in Reuben, Gad, and Zebulun. Okay, so that's how they divided up by clan. So it wasn't like your clan was scattered throughout the land. The Levites were kind of divided up in clans as well. Verses 3 through 5 talks about the pasture land. So they would get a city plus pasture land. Okay, now there was a lot of discussion on exactly what this means, and I was like, who cares? Because basically, here's the deal. What it says is they get 1,000 cubits north of the city, south of the city, whatever, whatever. And then it says it's 2,000 by 2,000 square. So what it basically was this was 2,000 cubits, 2,000 cubits, 2,000, right, and 2,000. And your city is in the middle. Now, they're arguing that if this is 2,000, you can't have 1,000 this way and 1,000 this way, because of course the city has to take up some space, right? I'm like, does it really, really matter? Back then, cities are not cities like Los Angeles. Cities are like tiny towns, okay? So regardless of whether it really was 1,000 and 1,000, so this was gonna probably be 2,000 something cubits total, they knew, okay? Whatever it was, they knew how to do it. They knew exactly what the pasture lands was. The idea is that God is providing for them a city, a place to live, and enough land to graze your cattle. This is not land to grow your crops, so they don't need a ton of land. They just need enough land to graze their cattle, because remember, they got the tithe. So they got 10% of what everybody else grew around them anyway. So they didn't necessarily need to grow their own stuff.
And I mean, verse 5 says, and you shall measure outside the city.
Right.
Right. East side, 2,000 cubits.
But their point, so that means the 2,000 square, so like it's a box.
Right.
Okay. But they're saying if the city takes up area in the middle, right, it's going to be more than 2,000 if you're taking 1,000 on each side.
Of the city boundary.
Yes, of the city boundary.
Right. It's just the way that it reads, it's like there's an established city, and then from that boundary, you would take 2,000.
No, because it just says 2,000, not from the city, but on the east side. So the whole east side is 2,000 cubits. Hmm. Yeah. Regardless,
right.
They got the land. They knew how to split it up. So I figured it wasn't worth the time and effort to try to figure it out myself. 1,000 cubits is about 1,500 feet. Okay, so it would be about 3,000 square feet of land-ish. 1,000 cubits is 1,500 feet. Okay, so if you're 1,000 on each side, it's going to be 3,000 square feet-ish. Okay. Questions, verse 1 to 5. K, Can someone read for me verses 6 to 15? Okay, so verse 6 to 8, the Levites get a total of 48 cities. Of the 48, 6 were going to be designated as cities of refuge. Okay, a city of refuge provided asylum and protection for someone who had committed manslaughter or other form of mortal injury. Okay, so if you kill someone. What's interesting is life is so important to God that he structures Israel's infrastructure around it. Okay, so 3 in Canaan proper and 3 in Transjordan. And again, the larger tribes are going to give more cities for the 48 and smaller tribes are going to give fewer cities, which would just make sense. Okay, then verse 9 to 14. We're talking about what the purpose of a city of refuge is. So these laws were to help maintain the purity and holiness of the land. It is God's land. And one thing that concluded it is the unjust shedding of man's blood. Okay. The existing custom in the ancient Near East was that if you killed somebody, that person's nearest male relative, it was their job to come kill you. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter if you did it by accident or if you did it on purpose. It didn't matter if it was premeditated murder or, oh no, you know, whatever. I mean, I think in Deuteronomy it gives the example as you're chopping wood and the axe head flies off on accident and kills someone. Okay, in the ancient Near East, didn't matter. If you killed someone, it was the job. They were called the Blood Avenger. It was their job to come and kill you. So what God does is he takes those existing customs and he modifies them. Okay. When a death occurred at the hands of another person, the killer was to flee to one of the cities of refuge. And we can see later that both murderer and manslaughterer probably fled because you had to stand trial. Okay, so if you were going to even survive until your trial, you needed to make it to a city of refuge. Okay. Verse 12, it says, the city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger. Okay, that avenger, that's the same word as like your kinsman redeemer. Because the person who was your kinsman redeemer would also be your blood avenger if you died. Okay, a kinsman redeemer would be your nearest male relative that could buy you back if necessary. If, you know, your husband dies or whatever, they can redeem your land so that you can survive as a woman, okay? So your kinsman redeemer and your blood avenger are going to be the same person. Then it says, verse 12, right? So that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. So, because when somebody dies, you don't necessarily know immediately if it's murder or if it's accidental. So you have to have a trial, and it was the job of the congregation of the leaders to determine murder versus manslaughter, accidental. Okay, so if the person, again, is going to survive, they have to make it, survive to make it to their trial, they're going to have to flee to a city of refuge.
So either way, they're going to die. They just have to have facts presented.
Yes. Yes. So once in the city of refuge, the blood avenger could not kill you until there was a trial. Now, if the trial determined it was murder, then we're going to see there is no protection for you. Okay? Then the blood avenger can kill you right there, right there at the trial if that's the verdict, okay? But if it's manslaughter, the blood avenger cannot if you've made it to a city of refuge.
I thought when you were in the city of refuge and you'd had the trial and it was like it was an accident.
Yes.
Then you could stay there until the priest died.
Yes.
And that you couldn't be killed.
Correct. Correct. So, and we'll get there. But if you are declared accidental death, right, you're still a killer, you don't get off scot-free. You don't get to go back to your land and your home and just live your life, right? You have to now stay in that city of refuge. So there still is punishment for taking a life, even accidental. And then you have to stay there until the high priest dies, which you don't know when that's going to be. It could be tomorrow. It could be you die first. Right? I mean, depending on how old the high priest is and how old you are, and, you know, you don't know. So you have to stay there. And the blood avenger cannot kill you as long as you are in the city of refuge. If you leave that 2,000 square cubits or whatever, then you're basically saying, come and get me. And then if the blood avenger kills you, he is not guilty of murder. And we'll talk about why all that is as we get there. Okay? Okay, so verse 15, it says, these six cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel and for the alien and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there. Like all of the other laws God gives, they apply to the foreigner dwelling among Israel as well, okay? And Israel was always to treat foreigners well because they were to always remember that at one point they were foreigners in Egypt. Okay, so the rules applied across the board. Okay, and again, there are six total, three in Canaan proper and three in Transjordan, so that everybody, and I think when it lists them in Deuteronomy, they're about equidistant apart to try to make it so that everybody is as close as they could. I mean, obviously, some people are going to be way closer than others, but to make it so it's not, you know, I'm all the way in South Israel and I have to flee all the way up to Galilee to get to a city of refuge. It wasn't like that.
So up in verses 6 and 7, yeah. Six cities were for refuge.
Yes.
And then it's 42 cities were for
just living in. They all had pasture land. So the Levites got a total of 48 cities. Of those, 42 were just regular cities. They had no special anything. They just, the Levites lived in them. Six of the cities were specifically cities of refuge, still inhabited by Levites, still having their pasture land. It's just if you killed somebody, you had to get to one of those six cities. Okay. Can someone read for me verses 16 to 29?
But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. And if he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. And if he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something at him, lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity or hurled anything on him without lying in wait or used a stone that could cause death and without seeing him dropped it on him so that he died, though he was not his enemy and did not seek him harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood in accordance with these rules. And the congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he has fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. for he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And these things shall be for a statute and for a rule for you throughout your generations in all your dwelling places.
Okay, so here we get the particulars and how they had to differentiate between murder and manslaughter. Okay, manslaughter just being accidental killing. So verse 16 through 18, we have three different objects back then that you could kill with, right? Iron, stone, and wood. Okay, all can be used with lethal force. And three times, right? He is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. If you killed someone with malice or premeditation, there was no escape for you. Okay? There was no prison for life or whatever nonsense. You were dead. Okay? And that goes back all the way to Genesis. Can someone read for me Genesis 9, verses 5 and 6? Okay, so this is in after the flood. God is making a covenant with Noah. And part of it is if you kill someone, you forfeit your life. Okay, why? Because man is made in the image of God. Man is totally different than animals. So you kill man, God's rule, you die. Okay, so now this is a fleshing out of those rules, of what he said in Genesis 9. Okay? So verses 6 through 18 deals with instruments. Verses 19 through 21 is more physical assault. Okay? Pushing, throwing something, beating him up, right? 20, if he pushed him of hatred, or threw something at him, 21, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity. Okay, so motivation is very key in determining murder versus manslaughter. Okay, because, well, we'll see in the next section, but in verses 16 to 18, it doesn't really address motive. It just says if you strike him with a stone and he dies, you're a murderer. Okay, but we're going to see in the later, it emphasizes there's no enmity, there's no malice, you know, you didn't mean to, okay? But if it's murder, there's no protection for the murderer. They have to die, and that is the job of the blood avenger, and that's what verse 19 says. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. So that was his job. Verses 22 to 28, so verses 22... And 23 really emphasize the accidental, okay? And notice what it says. Okay, if you pushed someone, so that's the same as verse 20, if he pushed him, okay? But what did it say? Without enmity, right? You're not angry at him. You don't hate him. He's not your enemy. Or threw something at him. Again, parallels verse 20, which is murder, okay? Without lying in wait. So you didn't, you know, it's not premeditated. You're not trying to kill him. Verse 23, or with any deadly object of stone. So you hit him with something and without seeing it drop on him so that he died while he was not his enemy nor seeking his injury. So really the big difference between murder and manslaughter is motivation, right? Did you do this because you hate this person, you have a problem with this person, you lay in wait for this person to cause him harm, or was it just a total accident and you never had a problem with this person and you guys were buddies, you know? I mean, you hear the crazy stories of people throws a baseball, right? And it just hits you in the exact right spot in your temple and the person just drops dead. You know, things can happen. Accidents happen. People die by total accident. And so now you have to determine what really happened, but motivation it matters greatly. Verse 24, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger. Okay, so it's like, I mean, it's like any today, if you killed someone, you're still going to go to court and they're going to try to determine, did you murder him or was it an accident, right? There's going to be the, you're going to be the defendant as the killer and there's going to be a prosecution. Okay, so here the prosecutor is the blood avenger and the defendant is the person who killed. Okay. Okay, so there has to be a trial, and the leadership has to determine. So because of this, I would assume that if you kill someone, even if it's murder, you got to flee to a city of refuge. Now, if it really is murder, and you know they're going to know it's murder, right, there's no question about it, you're probably just going to run for your life elsewhere, because you know if you go to a city of refuge, then there's going to be a trial, and they're probably going to convict you, and then you're going to die. So you might flee elsewhere and just try to stay out of the way of the blood avenger. I don't know. But if you think there's a chance that you could get off with manslaughter, you might flee to a city of refuge. Okay? Verse 25, it says, the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge. So it sounds like the trial takes place outside the city, so that if the verdict is murder, the blood avenger can just kill you right away, right? Because they're not going to want to kill you in the city, right? Because then that makes everything unclean, okay? So you got to do it outside the city. So it sounds like the trial is outside the city, but if the verdict is manslaughter, accidental death, then they get to safely usher you back into the city and the blood avenger can't kill you. Okay, then it says, end of verse 25, he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. What's interesting is the atonement for any death caused by another human is the death of another human. So if you murder, the atonement for that murder is your death. If it's an accidental death, if you cause an accidental death, then the atonement is the death of the high priest. Okay? And it's if you purposefully murder, your death is purposeful, right? If you accidentally murder, if you accidentally kill, then the atonement comes when the high priest by chance dies. Like you don't know when it's going to be. Okay? But the atonement for death is the death of another person, whether that be yourself or the high priest. Okay, and again, verses 26 to 28, you had to stay in the city. And if you left, you took your life in your own hands, and if the blood avenger catches up with you and kills you, then that is not murder for them. Because you did not wait for the death that atoned for your sin of killing another image bearer. Okay, now if the high priest dies, verse 26, but after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. Okay? So then you got to go back to your land and resume life as normal. And again, you had no idea when that was going to be. Could be tomorrow. It could be you die first, you know, and anywhere in between. Okay? Verse 29 says, these things shall be a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Okay? So these laws were to apply to all future generations. They do not change. Okay, this was not just for a period of time. This is how murderers were supposed to be dealt with. Okay. Questions? Okay, can someone finish up the chapter, read verses 30 to 34?
Shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel.
Okay, so these are just final issues. Verse 30, You cannot be convicted of murder on the evidence of one witness. Okay, it has to be two or more, right? With one, they could lie, they could make things up. With two, it's harder to get that collusion to have the same story. Okay, I mean, it's the same thing today. We have a lot of our modern laws from God's laws because they actually make sense and correlate with reality. Okay. Verse 31, you shall not take ransom. In the ancient Near East, if you were wealthy enough, you could buy your way out of a murder charge and you could buy your way out of an accidental charge with a bribe or a ransom. Oh, I accidentally killed your brother, but here, let me pay you money, right? And don't kill me to the blood avenger. Or I purposely killed your brother, but here, please don't kill me. I'll give you all this money. Okay. God says no for both. No money is allowed to compensate for death at all, bribe or ransom. He's very clear. He does not allow for this in either. Moreover, you shall not take a ransom for the life of a murderer. Verse 31, 32, you shall not take a ransom for him who has fled to a city of refuge. They may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So either way, if you killed somebody, there is no buying your way out. Because again, atonement for a death only comes by the death of another person. You cannot buy your way out of that. Why? Because we are created in the image of God. Okay, so there is no money that can compensate for the image of God. It doesn't exist. Okay. Then verses 33 and 34 talk about the theological reason behind this, right? You shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed except by the blood of him who shed it. So again, you kill somebody, their blood, and this reminds me of all the way back to Genesis, right? When God says, Cain, where's your brother? Cain says, I don't know, I'm not my brother's keeper. And what does God say? Do you remember? His blood cries out. I know because I hear his blood from the ground, right? When you shed the blood of man, it pollutes the ground and it cries out for justice, okay? And it says, verse 34, you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, right? This is God's land. He is dwelling in the middle of Israel. And they are to be an example to the nations of what it looks like to have a nation that works properly and God dwells in their midst. And murder is not part of that, of how things should operate, right? Never has been. So the unjust shedding of blood pollutes and defiles the land, and they are to represent God and be a light to the nations. Okay, so when there is shed blood, they need to deal with it the right way. Okay. Questions, chapter 35. Oh, like the people who have fled there and lived there? That's a great question. They might have to, I don't know if their families then, you know, have to somehow provide for them, or if the Levites in that city just take care of them. I have no idea. And again, remember, always remember with God's laws, this is what Israel was supposed to do. Whether or not they actually did, I don't know if there is even an example in scripture of anyone fleeing to a city of refuge. I don't know. I can't think of one off the top of my head. But this is how what they were supposed to do. Whether they did that in real life or not, I don't know. Okay. But that's a great question. My guess is be their families would have to provide for them in some way. Yeah. You know, because their family could come in and out no problem. They just couldn't leave. The person that actually killed couldn't leave. Their family could come and bring them food or money or whatever, and that wouldn't have been a problem. It's just they weren't allowed to go back to their land until the high priest died.
Kind of in a jail-type
yes. Manner. Yes, kind of. So if if you murder, then you're just instantly killed. But if you accidentally death, you are in a jail of sorts. I mean, that's a little more free than a prison cell, but yes. You are imprisoned in that city until the high priest dies. Other questions? All right, Numbers 36. Numbers 36 continues where Numbers 27 left off with the daughters of Zelophehad. Okay, so these are more issues related to inheritance. If you remember chapter 27, the daughters of Zelophehad from the tribe of Manasseh said, "Hey Moses, our dad is dead. He died as part of the first generation. He has no sons. It's not fair if our father's name goes out of existence because he doesn't get a part of the inheritance because he has no son." Moses consults with God, and God says, if a man has no sons, then the inheritance can pass to his daughters, which was groundbreaking. Okay, in the ancient Near East, daughters did not inherit ever, ever, ever. Okay, and God says, if you have no sons, then your daughters can inherit. Okay, so daughters now can inherit if there are no sons. So now we have another problem. Can someone read for me the whole chapter, verse 1 to 13?
Moses commanded the Israelites at the word of the Lord, "What the tribe of Joseph's descendants say is right. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning Zelophehad's daughters. They may marry anyone they like, provided they marry within the clan of their ancestral tribe. An inheritance belonging to the Israelites must not transfer from tribe to tribe, because each of the Israelites is to retain the inheritance of his ancestral tribe. Any daughter who possesses an inheritance from the Israelite tribe must marry someone from that clan of her ancestral tribe, so that each of the Israelites will possess the inheritance of his fathers. No inheritance is to transfer from one tribe to another, because each of the Israelite tribe is to retain his inheritance. The daughters of Zelophehad did as the Lord commanded Moses. Mahlah, Tirzah, Hadlah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, married cousins of their father's side. They married men from the clans of the descendants of Manasseh, son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained within the tribe of their father's clan. These are the commands and the ordinances the Lord commanded the Israelites through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho."
Okay, so specifically the clan of Maker, they had land in Transjordan east of the Sea of Galilee. That's what they had conquered, and this is where they're going to inherit. Now, they're very concerned about their inheritance. Right? So they approach Moses and the leadership, and their problem is, hey, you said the daughters of Zelophehad couldn't inherit. Well, now they're going to get married, right? Well, and now everyone wants to marry them, right? Because they come with land. But what happens if they marry somebody from the tribe of Reuben, or they marry someone from the tribe of Judah? Now, their land is going to become part of that tribe's land, and it won't even revert back to us in Jubilee because it was inherited land, right? In Jubilee, if you sold land, it reverted back to you in the year of Jubilee, okay? But here, this is inherited land. The daughters inherited this land, and they take it with them into a marriage. And so now we have, in the middle of our inheritance, Reuben owns a piece, and Judah owns a piece, and Simeon owns a piece. Like, that's not fair, right? What do we do about this? It's problematic when women inherit. Okay, verse 5, Moses tells them the answer, and it says it's according to the word of the Lord. So God had told him what the answer is. First, God says the tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. If you remember back in 27, when the daughters of Zelophehad said, hey, not fair. Our father doesn't get any part of the inheritance because he's dead and he has no sons. What does God say? Yeah, he does, but he first says, you're right in your statements. Right? What you say is right. It's a legitimate argument. Now, God is saying the same thing to the tribe of Manasseh. Your concerns are legitimate. What you say is right. Okay. Verse 6, the solution is the daughters of Zelophehad have to marry within the tribe of Manasseh. They can marry whoever they want, but they have to be from this tribe. They cannot marry somebody from Judah or Reuben or whatever. They have to marry someone from the tribe of Manasseh. Then their land will stay, their inheritance will stay within the tribe of Manasseh. Verses 7 through 9, it's interesting. Verse 7 and verse 9 are almost identical. Verse 7, thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. Verse 9, thus no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another tribe, for the tribes of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance. Okay, so when you have two statements that are exactly, almost exactly the same, right? It's an inclusio or a chiasm, right? So the emphasis is on what's in the middle. Right, so verse 8, every daughter who comes into possession of inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribe of her father, so the sons of Israel each may possess the inheritance of his fathers. Okay, so this does not apply just to Zelophehad and his daughters. This applies to any daughter throughout Israel that inherits. So if your father dies and has no sons and you inherit a portion of the land, you are obligated to marry someone within your own tribe. Yeah, yes.
When you think about thousands and thousands, didn't
right.
they have like 30 plus, the smallest one even, wasn't it? Like 30 plus thousand.
Right. But and the other thing is, this only applies to daughters who inherit, which if you think about it, is not going to be very many, because that means that the father had to have no sons. Okay, so most people have some girls and some boys. Yes, they're cousins. Right. Oh, that. The Zelophehad is what you're saying. Is that in Brie? Yes, but if you remember, Abraham married his half-sister. Right?
Well, look what happened after Noah got off the boat.
Right. They had to marry their cousins.
I mean, even Adam and Eve to start out with.
Right.
Had to marry.
Right. But, okay. No. Okay, but why do we have laws against not marrying your own cousin now, or your brother or your sister? Why are the laws there? It's genetic problems. The further back we go, the closer to creation you are, the less genetic problems there are, right? Adam and Eve were genetically perfect. So for Cain and Abel, or Cain and Seth, I suppose, to marry their sisters, they were not going to have the genetic problems that we have today, okay? Even all the way to David, when it's Absalom and is it Tamar? I think it's Tamar. There was another Tamar with Judah. But Absalom, remember, he is full of lust for his half-sister, right? And she says, don't do this thing. Just ask David and he will give me to you in marriage. So even all the way up to the time of David, which is going to be hundreds of years after this, right? It was more common to marry a relative, okay? And it probably didn't have the consequences that we have today because their genetics still weren't as messed up as ours are today, right? The longer sin has to go and our bodies break down and fail, our genetics get worse and worse, right?
And I mean, even now, aren't you able to marry your second cousin?
Or
is it third?
Oh, I think. I know you're not allowed to marry your first cousin.
Right, but I thought you were allowed to marry your second cousin now, like legally you
right,
could.
Right.
Which
yes.
I mean, you know, if you have thousands and thousands of people in your tribe.
Right. And these say uncles, sons, we're not given specifics of, you know. Yeah. So, but yes, it would have been their relatives, but they didn't even have to marry their cousins. They could have married somebody from another clan in Manasseh as well. Yeah, but that's a good question. But I mean, the reason we have those laws on the books are because of the genetics and because then the children, it's to protect the children of such a marriage is what it is.
Yeah. And it'd have to be within the half tribe that of whatever the split of Manasseh.
Yes, here it would. But for most other tribes, it would be, you know, because you would have your land all together.
The
split. Tribe. Yep. Okay, but it was extremely important, and even God emphasizes that land not pass from tribe to tribe. I mean, he says it in verse 7 and in verse 9. Okay, it's emphasized You do not pass land around from tribe to tribe. It remains in the tribe where God gave it. Okay. Verse 10 to 12, the daughters of Zelophehad, they obey. Okay? They marry their uncle's sons or their cousins, and their land stays within the tribe of Manasseh, which is very important. Okay? Verse 13, these are the commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Okay, so Numbers ends with a reminder again of where we are. Israel is poised to enter the promised land. Okay, remember Numbers as a whole is centered around the two censuses, Numbers 1, the old generation. Numbers 26, the new generation, right? In the middle of that is the killing off of the old generation. And after Numbers 26 is the preparation of the new generation to enter the land. So God has gotten rid of the old unfaithful generation. He has raised up a second generation that is going to enter the land. And they, for the most part, obviously they have issues. Everyone's going to have issues. But for the most part, they are a faithful generation. So Numbers ends with the obedience of Zelophehad's daughters, right? And if you remember the first 10 chapters of Numbers, Israel obeyed great. God said it, they did it. God said it, they did it. God said it, they did it, right? Because they were still at Sinai. And then as soon as they start to march, right, to the promised land, and they enter the wilderness, there's trouble, okay? And more complaining, and goes downhill until it culminates in refusal of the land, and God says, fine, you're going to wander. They wander for 40 years. They die. They die out until God raises up this second generation. Okay, now they are ready to enter the land. And again, reminder of the first 10 chapters of Numbers, they are obeying. God says it, and they're going to do it. Questions? Numbers 36 or the entire book of Numbers? Joyce, do you want to tell that to God? Jesus,
you made it through Leviticus. You know there's a lot of there about what we're supposed to do.
That's right. There is. There is. There's a lot in Deuteronomy.
For grandchildren.
What'd you say? Oh, Joyce, I hope you are pleasantly surprised. Oh my goodness. Well, ask the elders, see how they enjoyed Deuteronomy.
I feel like they quote it all the time, so they must have.
Yes.